which brings us to the message that we're going to have today. And what I want to do, brethren, I want to give you the title here as we work through this. But it's a title I think you will relate to. And it will spark something in your mind to think, well, I know where that came from. So I read that in my Bible. Because we read our Bibles. And the title is, brethren, The Handwriting is on the Wall. The handwriting is on the wall. Where did that come from? Where did that come from? Sound familiar? I think so. These things are handed down through time. And really what that harkens back to is a civilization that we have been part of, and we are the end time generation of, that had some semblance, some recognition, some memory, some idea of some of the outstanding things that are recorded in the Bible. Because our civilization, brethren, at some point in time going back, had some understanding of the Bible. But as we know now, that's becoming less and less and less. We have a very secular society in Canada. The United States has become more and more secularized, very much so, drifting away from the basic precepts of the Bible. Now, just because you hang on to basic precepts, brethren, doesn't mean you're part of the Church of God, but it does mean that you have an appreciation for some of the basic knowledge that has been handed to us in this book. And so when I say to you, the handwriting is on the wall, as a biblical concept, brethren, that has been used over and over and over again in conversation, in discussion, and so on. And so, again, this is a biblical concept that goes back to the book of Daniel, almost 2,500 years ago, actually. So, again, we're going to go through the significance of that little quote, that little statement, the handwriting is on the wall, because it applies very much so in the time period that we're living in, going up to these days of unleavened bread coming upon us in the next month to month and a half or so. And so we get prepared for that, as we do every year. But with a sense of urgency, it becomes greater every year, because we're descending farther and farther into the time of the end. So again, brethren, very carefully, let's set the stage by reading a couple of scriptures here in Exodus, the 12th chapter, which talks about what we do symbolically. It conveys something to try to make a point. So in Exodus, the 12th chapter, we read in verse 14. Now, we're not there yet, brethren, but this is what we're coming up to in 4 weeks, and we are planning. We're in a planning process, planning stages. It says here, began way back when, verse 14, and this day shall be a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. The argument comes up again and again and again between religionists and people who strive to follow Christianity as much as they understand. You don't have to keep the days of unleavened bread. There's no significance. You don't have to keep the holy days. There's no significance. We are new covenant Christians. And brethren, you couldn't miss the point further than a statement like that. New covenant Christians, of course, are commanded to keep this ordinance, as it says in the latter part of this verse, forever. Now, I don't know what part of forever most people don't understand. Forever, brethren, to me means forever, without break, without, you know, saying we don't have to do it anymore. It means forever. Somehow, they kind of think the new covenant is all about, well, you keep it for a period of time, but there comes a point in time where Christ does away with all of that. How on earth Do you square that with the words forever? I don't think you can. But in verse 15, it says, 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. My kids liked unleavened bread. I had some neighbors that liked unleavened bread. They come over and visit with us. They say, you know, you try it with peanut butter. Tastes pretty good. And so they kind of liked the idea of it. It wasn't suffrage. It wasn't saying, well, you know, we're suffering, we're putting ourselves out for this. Kind of tastes good. But there's a point to it again, brethren, as we go forward, we realize that we are preparing for something. We're preparing ourselves, brethren, for events leading up to the time of the end. That's what we're doing. We are in that crutch period of time where this world is going to experience dramatic changes very soon. And brethren, you and I are in the eye of the storm. And so when we look at it from that perspective, going forward to today's or this year's days of unleavened bread, what should we be thinking about? Yeah, de-leavening, brethren, is all about getting rid of sin symbolically. You know, the squished bread without any air in it, without any leavening in it to puff it up, symbolizes getting rid of sin. It really does. That's what it does. The symbolism is what is important. And that's why we do it. God has a way, brethren, of orchestrating things so that when we do something that he tells us to do, we get a message from doing it. And that's what unleavened bread is all about. So we go about cleaning our houses and so on and so forth, cleaning our cars, cleaning our living spaces to try to get rid of the filthy, wretched sin in our lives. That's what we do. And so let's go to verse 17, where it confirms this again. Verse 17 of Exodus 12, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for in this selfsame day have I brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. And don't you forget it, brethren. You know, human beings have a way of forgetting. They really do. I am forgetful, brethren. I was going over some old papers that I had 20 years ago, things that I had taken note of in the church, biblically speaking. I couldn't even remember writing that stuff. I couldn't. But yet I had. My signature was on it. And so we have this thing about us, brethren, as human beings, we tend to forget. God knew that when he created us. And he knew that we had to have reminders in our lives to remind us who we are, what we're doing, what we're to be doing, why, and all the rest of it. It says, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, verse 17, for in this exact same day have I brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore shall you observe this day and your generations for an ordinance forever. Brethren, coming out of Egypt was a type of coming out of sin. That's what it was about. That's why that happened. So for time immemorial, when God calls people and presents his truth to them, then he shows very clearly that there's a message, there's a hidden message there that we are to take note of. It says, therefore shall you observe this day and your generations for an ordinance forever throughout all time, unbroken. And brethren, that identifies God's people more than anything else, because you will find where God's people are, that's what they're doing. They are keeping God's commands. One of his commands is to keep the holy days. And we can go forward, brethren, I don't have time to do this, but in 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, verse 6 through 8, it says, let us keep the feast, not with the leaven of malice or wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. It says, keep the feast. What's Paul talking about? He's saying we are to keep the feast, just like it did back in Exodus, where Moses was conveying a message from God and says, keep the feast for a reason. Now we're going to be at Eugene and Kim's house for the night to be remembered, I believe. I hope that's... We're going to be at the Passover. We're going to be at Passover at Dr. Moore's and Rita's house. Why? Because God says you have to do it. I'm commanding you to do it. So, brethren, don't ever stop doing it. There are all kinds of arguments, all kinds of twisted reasoning that people come up with. Mr. Goss, he brought that point out. He said, when you have a calling, don't turn your back on it. Take it seriously. Go forward. Move forward. Don't look back. Don't ever look back. Brethren, that is the platform or the basis I have laid for this message going forward, because I want to draw on the seriousness, the sobriety of the world that we live in that will impel us to really get ready for the Passover, to really get ready for the Days of Unleavened Bread, to really get ready for those things that symbolize what is coming on us, because we live in a world, brethren, that's not God's world. Well, he does own it, actually. But it's not really his world governmentally, because his government is not here. He's allowed Satan to continue to have control and hold sway over this world, as so obviously is the case when you look at world news. Brethren, have you ever heard this saying? Many, many tekel upharsin. Have you ever heard that? I think you have. You read the book of Daniel. And it's a message for our day, brethren. It really is. I'm going to go through that a little bit and show what that meaning really does mean. I had an old friend in the church years ago. He used to jokingly say, many, many tickle the parson. So it was kind of a takeoff on that saying, jokingly so. But what it is, brethren, there's a significant meaning to this. Many, many tekel upharsin. And we're going to read about that. If you'll turn with me over to Daniel, the fifth chapter. I want to read here about something that was recorded so very, very long ago by the prophet Daniel. A message directly from God for our purpose today. I want to go through most of this chapter, brethren. I think you'll find it very interesting because there are certain things that are stated here that we can apply spiritually speaking, to ourselves, to analyze ourselves, to ask ourselves, am I like this old pagan king that lived back then with a carnal mind and a carnal mindset? Am I like him, or am I overcoming and becoming more like God, more like his mindset, and more like the prophet Daniel, who was one of God's men? Let's start, brethren, by reading in verse 1 of the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Party time, you bet. This was a real party. This was a big celebration of something. But what was it oriented towards? Was it oriented toward God? Was it oriented toward his law and his way of life? I don't think so. Let's read a little bit further. Verse 2. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels. Oh, interesting. What vessels were these? Which his father or grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken out of the temple. God's temple. When they had invaded one of the two or three invasions of the land of Judea, where the Babylonians had invaded, and they did it two or three times. The final one was the conclusion of that entire episode where it was totally over. But it says here, taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, the king and the princes, his wives and his concubines might drink in them. Brethren, that was abominable, because those temple accoutrements and so on, those various artifacts from the temple were specifically to be used in the service of God Almighty. And this pagan king, grandson to Nebuchadnezzar, he thought, oh, let's just flaunt it. We've got a great big party going on here, a great big celebration of the greatness of Babylon. Let's flaunt it. And so they took those vessels out of the temple. And verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold. Can you imagine that? Using some of God's special vessels dedicated to Him and using them to try to promote some pagan deity. Can you imagine? The gods of gold, of silver, brass, and iron, wood, and stone. Verse 5, in the same hour came the fingers of a man's hand. Can you imagine? Can you just picture, brethren, this whole thing that's going on? A room filled with 1,000 officials of Babylon celebrating how great Babylon was, supposedly, a human empire, tyrannical in so many respects, it really was, celebrating, having a great old time. They didn't have electrical lighting in those days. They probably had large candlesticks that lit up this massive banquet hall. And into the evening, I guess, as it went. And they're partying. The same hour. The fingers of a man's hand. A disembodied hand. And probably no arm. Probably no body attached to this. Just fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. Now that king, brethren, that little itty-bitty king, that egocentric king, he saw it. And I imagine he started to quake in his shoes. What have I done? He saw that because it was so supernatural. He couldn't deny it. But again, he wrote on the candle, wrote against by the candlestick in the plaster of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Now look at verse 6. It says, the king's countenance was changed. I guess so, brethren. I guess so. Maybe deep down in his heart, he knew, what have I done? And it troubled him so that the joints of his legs or his loins loosed and his knees smote together. That's fear, brethren. You imagine sitting in your chair, you're so scared, you just start shaking uncontrollably. That's possible, humanly speaking. It's happened at times, but it's extreme fear that creates that. The king cried, verse 7, aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers, and the king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet. In other words, I can make you a great person. Just tell me what this means. Tell me what these words mean. So they went all through the kingdom. They tried to find somebody that could do it. And he even said, I promise you, you can do that. I will promote you to be the third ruler of the kingdom. Pretty promising, wasn't it? Somebody could step up to the plate and I can make up the story that maybe please him. I'll get to be the third ruler of the kingdom. I'm sure the thoughts were there. Verse 8, then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Couldn't do it. Verse 9, then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. This guy's starting to fall apart. He's starting to cave. He's starting to implode. This is our king, our great, wonderful king. Verse 10, now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spoke and said, King, live forever. Of course, you come into the presence of one of these, leading potentates. And that's what you do. You say, live forever. Else, if you don't, you show honor and respect to them. If you don't, then you're not going to live very long. That's the point. Let not your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance be changed. Verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. They knew Daniel was a special person because he had identified dreams previously in that kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar, and dispelled some of the mystery of those dreams. So they still knew Daniel was kicking around. He might have been quite old at this time, or getting older. He was still around, but not being paid much attention to. Again, it says, in whom the spirit of the holy gods is, the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. Special person. Found in him. Whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather, the king, your father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, soothsayers. And brethren, you know, it's kind of a funny thing because you talk about picking your counselors. Now, if you want to be deceived, pick a bunch of false prophets, astrologers, soothsayers to try to steer you. And which way are you going to go? How are you going to end up? I guess the answer is pretty obvious. You start to think vain thoughts about your own self because they're there to build up your pride and not to tell you the truth. So let's go forward to verse 13. Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel, which are the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of jewelry?" And of course that was the southern kingdom, became known as the Jews, the children of Judah. And of course that's what happened. He came out early on prior to the final captivity. And skipping further ahead, we don't want to read every verse here, but it says in verse 18, "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather, a kingdom, majesty, glory, and honor." Nebuchadnezzar came to know that, brethren, but it took him a while to figure it out because he kept reverting back to the pagan gods that he had been worshiping. It was kind of like a tug of war with Nebuchadnezzar. He's pulled in two directions his entire life until finally he just came to the point where he said, "Yes, I know that God, your God, Daniel, is the God." And for verse 19, "The majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew." That's a typical dictator. "And whom he would, he kept alive." In other words, he's just a snap decision, brethren. We're very fortunate to live in the sort of latter stages of the democratic Western nations, which have afforded some semblance of freedom, which is a one-time experience in the history of humanity, because humanity has not experienced very much freedom down through the ages. Not at all. Humanity have lived under the rule of tyrants, dictators, despots. You look down through history and that's been the experience. And we're starting to come back into that again, brethren. People have not appreciated the freedoms that have been afforded through the Western Israelite nations in this world. But again, it says, verse 20, "When his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him." This is talking about an event where he was cast out of his kingdom for a period of 7 years, which became seven prophetic times. But tying that together, brethren, he's talking about the hand on the wall and how that connects with the seven prophetic times. He was driven from his sons, the sons of men, and his heart, verse 21, was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he will. Till he really gets it. Humanity still doesn't get it to this day, brethren. We're going to go through a time period just ahead of us to bring that home very forcefully to humanity so that humanity will get it, just like this ancient king began to get it. But it says, "You, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart," verse 22, "though you knew all this." He knew it, brethren. He kind of put in the back of his mind, out of sight, out of mind. And he just basically drew a blank on it. And this is why he descended into idolatry and pagan practices to the point where he's giving a great feast to all of his lords and co-rulers and leaders of his government. Verse 23, but have lifted up yourself against the eternal of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of the house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine in them, and you have praised the gods of silver, of gold, of brass, iron, wood, stone, which see not nor hear. They're inanimate. They are inanimate, brethren. And the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways, have you not glorified? Thence and hence came the fingers of the man's hand. Verse 24 and verse 25, and this is what it wrote. And this is the writing that was written. Many, many, tekel, upharsin. And then as Daniel further proceeds, this is the interpretation of the thing. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you are weighed in the balance and are found wanting. Perez, which is another term for upharsin. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Brethren, right at that particular point in time, when they were having this great banquet and great feast, they were teetering on the brink, unknowingly, of a massive collapse and invasion by a power that was at the gates of Babylon and about to invade and take over that city. And this king was about to lose his life. Because as it says here, then commanded Belshazzar, he clothed Daniel after he heard the interpretation and put the chain on his neck. Verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of Chaldea, slain. It was over that fast. And God's judgment came, brethren. And the fingers of the man's hand came true initially at that point. But I want to go back, brethren, at this point and clarify the exact understanding of these words, which have been there for time immemorial and are directed directly at us in the end of the age. And when we know that, brethren, as the church of God, God's people, when we understand that, then we do a self-analysis, don't we? We say, am I drifting towards the mindset of Belshazzar, or am I reflecting the mindset of the prophet Daniel, who understood? Brethren, I'll just go very quickly through this here to explain the meaning of these ancient words. You'll find it very interesting. The word many is translated 50. In other words, many is a monetary symbol, and it represents 50. 50 what? Well, 50 shekels. That's what it means. 50 shekels. Now, he says it twice, so you've got two minis, or manys. That's two 50s. Tekel is another term for shekel. The Babylonian shekel in their monetary system means one shekel. So you've got two 50s, another one shekel, and you got upharsin. Upharsin is a term for 25 shekels. Now, if you add this all together, what we got is a total of 126 shekels. 126 shekels. It's important to note, brethren, that a shekel has 20 numerical components to it, known as gerahs. And so a shekel has 20 gerahs. The whole point here, brethren, is that God uses numerology in the Bible. He doesn't leave us without some footprints as to what's going on, time elements that have taken place over vast periods of time to understand prophetic events as they come and go. And so when you really understand what's being said here, you have the term 126 and then 20 gerahs, and if you multiply that out, you come up with the term 2,520 Now, that's not by coincidence, brethren, because that is a term that keeps coming up again and again and again in the Old Testament of the Bible. It comes up in the New Testament as well. And it fits various prophetic scenarios. Dr. Moore gave an excellent viewpoint video on the Balfour Declaration, and there is an element of this 2,520 years that can come up in that, and it probably does fit in some way. So it's interesting. We are living in the time of the end. These things compute out to our time. I want to show you how this one computes out, but before we do that, let's go over to Daniel, the fourth chapter, again, to reconfirm that there is something interesting about all of this. Daniel, the fourth chapter, and we read in verse 15, I guess we can go to, it says, "Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots." Now, in this particular chapter, we're talking about how Nebuchadnezzar was compared to a tree, a great tree that seemed to control or overreach the entire earth. And it depicted his kingdom. His kingdom was a massive world-ruling empire. And he was the head of it. And again, as it was stated in the previous reading, it showed that he was set up as a king of that kingdom. But because of his vanity, because of his self, you know, centric view of self, how he was the one and the only one, I guess, you know, kings tend to do that, that God had to knock him down. And typically, that's what he did. It says, verse 15, "Leave the stump of the roots." He cut the tree down. A watcher from heaven was going to come and cut that tree down, cut, in effect, Nebuchadnezzar down, typical of his kingdom. His kingdom was going to come to an end. The prophecy of the handwriting on the wall was going to take place. But here he was told previously about this same thing that was about to happen. "Leave the stump of the roots in the earth, even with a band of iron," verse 15. The tree was to cut down. A band of iron was to be placed around the stump so that at some point in time that stump could resprout and come back to life. Typical, I guess, of Nebuchadnezzar. But also typical of a later period of time, because you see, brethren, the entire system of Babylon has been with us since that time. It's come and gone at various points in history, but we still have it with us. The European Union is the latest manifestation of that Babylonian system. They even proudly have a flag of the EU that is depicting the beast, Babylon, symbols over there. That's what they have. They proudly show it. They're not denying it. It's all there. And so it's a manifestation of that. Interesting points in prophecy as we go through this, brethren. It says here, the important part, brethren, I want to just highlight here, verse 16, "Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given to him." So, again, what was about to happen to Nebuchadnezzar was a type of the Babylonian kingdom, how it would come crashing down and be taken over by the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. Verse 17, "This matter is by the decree of the watchers and demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men." Brethren, ultimately, Babylon is going to be destroyed again at the return of Jesus Christ in a few years. It's going to be completely leveled, and it will be swept from the pages of history, never to rise again, because the kingdom of God will be established on this earth. But again, certain important things in these prophecies. It says in verse 16, "He would be given a beast's heart and be given to him, and let," this is important, brethren, "seven times pass over him. What is that? The Bible uses this kind of terminology at times, brethren, to illustrate a period of time that God is revealing. And that's the same. It synchronizes with the 2,520 years that Daniel was talking about when Babylon ultimately fell in 539 BC. You need to file that date in your mind, brethren, if you haven't already. 539 BC is the exact date of the fall of Babylon. There was a reason why it is so well known, because God wants it to be known. This is revelation from God. His prophecies are open to the church of God. We understand these things. And so we can watch and we can apply and see how God is working things out down here below. Verse 25, again, it reiterates the point. Seven times shall pass over you till you know the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. Seven times, brethren, if you work it out and break down the components of it, comes out to 2,520 years. Seven times 360 days in a year. Same thing. So God says, if you don't get this one focus of prophecy, I'll write it again for you in another way and see if you get it that way. And so that's what he did. But this is consistent through the Bible, brethren. God uses numberings. He really does. He uses dates, significant dates, and he's made it plain to his church sometimes after the fact. 539 BC going forward, 2,520 years, what do you come up to? Does anybody know? 2,520 years going forward from 539 BC, what date do you come up to? Well, I'll make it easy for you, brethren, unless Scott's got it figured out. You skip, you don't count the year zero when going forward, of course, so that brings you 1 year farther ahead, and you come up with the year 1982. Did anything significant happen in 1982? Well, brethren, it's rather interesting to note that in 1982, we are in the midst of a rapid expansion of the power of the European Union as it was morphing more into an actual unit, a unit less like a group of nations, into a real unified group of nations, and looking at themselves more and more as a union. In October 1 of 1982, the driving force, as it has been throughout history, has been Germany. Germany has been the driving force of the European Union. It's like they control it. Oh, they let the French along just to keep them happy. I guess you can do that with the French, you know, the Reubenites. You can let them come along and try to placate them, keep them happy, let them think they're in the driver's seat when they're really not. But that's the way the Germans have been. They controlled the European Union, but it was coming into greater control. Their chancellor in October 1, 1982, had been voted out of office by Parliament, by the Reichstag. And he was replaced rather quickly by a very pro-European Union chancellor named Helmut Kohl. Helmut Kohl was instrumental going forward, brethren, in implementing more and more of this unification effort of the European Union, to the point where 7 years after the fact, the Berlin Wall fell, and then we know what happened there, the eastern leg of the European Union, or the beast, began to come into play and began to come out from under the control of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union fell. And what we had was the eastern nations, as Mr. Armstrong repeatedly had told us, they were going to come and be a part of that beast. And that's what we saw began to happen. Now, it became a very strong monetary union, a very dominant economic force, but it was not ever strong militarily, and it has not been up to this day. So you have those questions. Fast forward to today, where we have Brexit. Have you heard of Brexit? Brexit, brethren, is the effort of the stiff-necked Ephraimites. You know, you want to get an Ephraimite mad at you, don't tell him what he has to do. I know, I think I'm one anyway. Don't tell him he has to do this or he has to do that. He'll rebel. They have come to sort of wake up to the fact that they have been taken over by a dictatorship. That's what the European Union is in actual fact. They don't want any part of it anymore. They want their independence. And so there's a struggle going on right as we speak to try to decouple from that economic monetary union that that government known in Brussels as the European Union. And it's not going to end pretty, brethren, because they say if the British leave without a deal, and it looks possible, we don't know whether that's going to happen exactly that way, but they will leave. They're not going to be part of the beast power, brethren, going forward. There's no way, because they're Israelite. They're stiff-necked. They don't like to be told what to do. And so they don't like some foreign power making 80% of the decisions of their laws without their say. That's what's happened, and they're sort of waking up to it. You know, you pull yourself out from a pub long enough, you start to get your bearings, and you start to see things clearly. You know, a lot of times they spend too much time in their pubs. We spend a lot of time, brethren, in our Tim Hortons donuts. You can tell the difference between an Ephraimite in England and an Ephraimite over here. They're probably slender and so on, because all they do is drink beer. And over here, we eat donuts. After time, you can kind of identify the difference, the way we look. But anyway, it's not going to end pretty, brethren, because as it's understood, if and when the British pull out of the European Union, it's going to crash the German economy. The Germans probably don't like to talk a lot about that, but most economists recognize the fact that they are dependent upon these markets to keep their economy chugging along at a powerful rate. When that happens, brethren, nothing can be taken for granted because the whole system begins to unravel and collapse. It really does. You go back to the 1930s, the early 1930s, what was it that allowed Hitler to come to power? What was it? An economic collapse that had taken place in the Weimar Republic of Germany. And they were taking wheelbarrows of money to pay for a loaf of bread. How long does that keep the population happy? Not very long. They're not happy for very long. They get pretty upset. You see that going on in Venezuela, where people are borderline starving. The government is breaking down. The entire system is breaking down. We're living in a world where that's going to happen again, brethren. It's going to happen. And massive changes are underway as we speak. But again, here we see that in Daniel, the second chapter, a description of what we are looking at right now and have been looking at right now in Europe, the European Union, as we speak, how it's characterized. It's a rather interesting description. Anciently, God called it, brethren. This was written almost 2,600 years ago. 2,600 years ago. People say God doesn't know what he's talking about. He really does know what he's talking about, all right. Because he can prophesy way off into the future and call it in precise detail. And this is one of those times. It says here in Daniel 2, and verse 40. Daniel 2, verse 40, the fourth kingdom. This is the kingdom known as the Roman Empire in various ways it has come together down through history. It's come together numerous times. And brethren, what I want to do at this particular point, if you're not aware of it, I think in one of our publications, we have a prophetic chart that has been in existence in the Church of God for many, many, many years. It's a very good chart. It's highly accurate. It was put together originally by Mr. Armstrong many years ago and has stood the test of time. But it's talking about the various manifestations of the Roman Empire. And that is depicted by this fourth kingdom broken down into different components over time as it played out. Now look at what it says about this kingdom at the very end. This is talking about our time right now. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces. That's the way it had been up until our time. For as much as iron breaks in pieces, subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. A powerful military force. And the Roman Empire has been that since its original inception back in B.C., a couple hundred years B.C., whatever it was. Going forward to our time, it says, verse 41, and whereas you saw the feet and toes, the end time manifestation, if you follow the prophetic charts, you're looking at it, brethren. This is talking about the European Union as we see in Europe. Not its final configuration, but as it morphs going forward. As you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. It hasn't quite come fully together as we speak. We've seen the wrestling with that. A political power coming together, bringing together numerous nations. Right now it stands at 28, I believe it is. When Britain leaves, it'll be down to 27, but there is room for a lot more change in the next few years, of course. Feet and toes, part of iron, part of clay. The kingdom shall be divided, but there shall not be in it of the strength of the iron. In other words, not militarily, it won't have that same strength it had in the past. Because it's mixed with clay. It's trying to bring together different ethnicities, different nations, and so on, to try to bring it into some kind of a kingdom, and so on. Verse 42, as the toes of the feet were part of iron, part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And that is what we have seen, brethren, up to this point. That is exactly what we have seen. And this thing is going to continue, and there will be changes as we go. And certainly what is lacking at this point in time is a very powerful personality known as the beast and his companion, the false prophet. When you see economic collapse into that vortex, you will see people come along that will take advantage of the situation and very quickly change things around. In the early 1930s, Hitler changed Germany and turned it around very quickly. Very, very quickly. Revelation, the 17th chapter. Revelation, the 17th chapter. Again, another take on this, but this was written 700 years later, saying God inspired it. It's talking about the same thing, another take on it. And it says here, we come to probably around the 1940s, 1930s. And, of course, Mussolini, and he was benefiting from Garibaldi, who reunited Italy in the late 1800s, and then some of these prophecies began to take place again at that point in time, coming into the time of the end. Revelation 17, verse 10. There are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. Well, that other ultimate king, brethren, has not yet come. We see a parliamentary system, the European Union, in its present state, but it's lacking the beast and the false prophet. And somehow they are going to be injected into this to take it to another level altogether. And then end time events, brethren, are going to transpire very, very quickly. That says in the Bible that the day and the hour knows no man. And then it also says sudden destruction shall come. Brethren, it's not going to come on the Church of God, not on Philadelphians. God promises he will protect the Philadelphians of his church. He really will. He's not playing games with that. But he's not going to protect Israel, because Israel is going to go into a national enslavement, a national captivity under that beast power one more time. Going through the tribulation, it is going to happen. So we see that in these verses. Verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw. Now perhaps it will contract a little bit. We know it right now stands at 27 independent nations. Somehow that is going to contract or change in some way so that the final configuration is something like 10 nations or groups of nations or ethnicities. That's what will happen. 10 kings. And these people will willingly and gladly hand over their power to the beast for 1 hour, as it says. And of course, that 1 hour is approximately 3.5 years. These have one mind, verse 13, and shall give their power and strength to the beast. Brother, why am I reading these scriptures anyway? Why am I talking about prophecy? You say, well, you're coming up to the days of unleavened bread. Let's talk about getting cleaned up. Well, brethren, that is one of the big reasons why we talk about prophecy. One third of the Bible is prophecy. 90% of it applies or pertains to our day. There's a reason why. It inspires us as a church. It motivates us as a church. And it also can comfort us, brethren, because the ultimate prophecy, of course, is Jesus Christ is going to return and change everything and make this world a beautiful and wonderful place. But that's prophecy, brethren. There's a reason for it. And it ought to inspire us. It ought to lift us. It ought to encourage us. And we ought to feel blessed when God reveals these things very plainly to us. Revelation, the 13th chapter. Revelation 13. You know, I just started, brethren. I only got 2 hours to go. Just kidding. But anyway, Revelation, the 13th chapter. It says here in verse 11, it says here, it's talking about the Roman Catholic Church riding the beast, but it says, verse 11, I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. That's Satan the devil working through some powerful charismatic religious leader in the world soon to come. He spoke as a dragon. This guy was really in sync with the devil. He says he exercises all the power of the first beast before him and causes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So again, that beast is going to come back full force, not just as some political entity of iron mixed with miry clay, but it's going to go to an entirely new level under the direction of these two individuals. Why? Why? Well, look at what he can do. Can you imagine if President Donald Trump could call fire down from heaven? All of the media and all of the naysayers would say, I'm convinced now. But not really. If Justin Trudeau or any of the leaders that you know of could do this, it would allay all of the concerns. You would have the meeting out of your hand. But this is what this guy is going to do. Verse 13, he does great wonders so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. I don't think, brethren, that's symbolic. It sounds real. I mean, the Bible, it is given. It is symbolism. It really is in many, many respects, especially the book of Revelation. But this sounds too precise for it to be symbolic. It sounds like it's actually going to happen. Whether the news stations, the television stations will be able to zero in on this guy as he comes into play, and he's going to be on television all over the world calling fire down from heaven, major headlines, major news stories, and so on. What's that going to do to the population, brethren? It's going to deceive them in ways that you can't even imagine. It's going to be incredible. The deception is going to be 100%. But it says here, he deceives them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles. Satan's man, brethren, by the means of those miracles which he has power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power, verse 15, to give life to the image of the beast, that the beast should speak. In other words, people think, well, the European Union is on its death legs. It's on a death. It's experiencing its death knell right now. Well, the Bible, brethren, says it's got a little ways to go, and it's going to come together in a formidable force that will form alliances all over this world with the Gentile nations to take out the West. We are coming to the point, brethren, where we are going to see a post-Israel world. The Western nations of Israel are going to collapse. They're going to be taken into captivity. The freedoms that we have been afforded will be gone. We are entering into a new dark age, and we can see it all around us. I just want to give you a few statistics at this point, brethren. I think you'll find them interesting because people kind of take for granted. Look at the world we live in. Look at Canada. I mean, it's been around for 200, well, not 200, but 170 years or whatever it is. 160 years. It's been around for a long time. It's afforded comfort. We won two world wars, the Allies. And it seemed we were invincible. And to this day, brethren, people take that for granted, that these countries are invincible. The United States, they say, is invincible, the greatest military power on the face of the earth. Oh, really? When you look below the surface, it's corrupting. It's failing. It's beginning to disintegrate. And there are a lot of things going on, brethren, that show very clearly that it is very close to the end of its run as the greatest military economic power in the history of the world. Now, people get upset. They say, well, make America great again, brethren. People can get upset about that because they say, well, who are you? You go back to Genesis, the 12th chapter. God says, I will make of you a great nation. But it's only for a time. And it's only as long as you generally walk in my ways. When you start to depart from my ways, then all bets are off. It's over. You go contrary to God as a nation, as these nations are so obviously, brethren, time is running out. And in a sense, the handwriting is on the wall of our society today as we prepare for the days of unleavened bread. But here we go. This is interesting. Not too many commentators want to pay attention to this. In 2000, at the turn of the century, guess what the world debt, the world economic debt was in rounded figures? If you could guess, brethren, it was approximately $80 trillion. $80 trillion. 2000, year 2000, we fast forward 8 years to the beginning of the presidency of Barack Obama. And right at that point in time, there was a massive recession. They call it the Great Recession. What do you think the world debt was in roughly 2008? Well, it had exploded forward to about or approximately $125 trillion. Now that's almost a third more than what it was in 2000. I think you could probably guess where I'm going with this, because we're talking about where is it today? 2019, world debt, showing the ominous situation we're in. Can you believe $250 trillion? How do you put your mind around that figure? Most economists who really know about this, brethren, are very worried. And to a person, they're all saying the same thing. This can't go on. It's like stretching a balloon. You can only stretch it so far until it explodes. That's the economic order or system that we're in. And then throw into the mix Brexit, upsetting the apple cart of the European Union, which is not a strong economy either, by the way, and the potential of Germany imploding economically. I mean, you just put it all together, brethren. That's just one aspect of the whole thing. Now, let's take a look at a commentary. I took some of the bullet points or the major points of a commentary that I took off the internet by a respected commentator. He was quoting various sources to put this together. Collapse of the Western civilization. How do you know? Well, aside from the economic part, here are some things that are going on before our very eyes, and I think we see it on a day-to-day basis if we turn the news on. From spiritual bankruptcy to mass chemical dependence. Do you know, people are so concerned about where do I get my drugs from? I'm not talking about street drugs. I'm not talking about cocaine, marijuana, although that's now illegal in Canada and many places in the United States, because people can't function without drugs, without dealing with the upset of the mind. We are a drug-enslaved culture. We can't deal without it. But it says, from spiritual bankruptcy to mass chemical dependence. Probably the most well-known store outlet in any community is the pharmacy. Yeah, I can't survive without my prescription. It didn't used to be that way, brethren. It didn't used to be that way at all. But we are feeling the stresses of modern life so much, to the point that we cannot function in a normal way. We have to be all drugged up. Rampant addiction to sensual stimulation. In other words, things you can see, things that get your mind distracted from the reality of the world. All of that. People spend the better part of a day on the internet trying to find a distraction to stimulate them, to try to take their mind away from the things that are going on. Our society, brethren, is imploding before our eyes, and it is very close to crossing that threshold where there is no return. It says here, every factor that precedes the collapse of a great civilization has been met by the West, the Western world. Brethren, we as a church of God should not feel comfortable in this world. We really shouldn't. We take comfort in God's truth, in His church, in the Bible, in prophecy, in what's going on, and what's going forward. That's where we get our comfort from, brethren, and that's where we need to get it from. It says here, next point, our destruction is long overdue. Long overdue. Paul Harvey, if you know or have heard of the name, he was probably the most prominent media personality in the United States for many years. He died a few years ago at the age of 91, I believe it was. But he had commentary every day on the major radio stations in the United States, and some of them reached up to here. And in 1965, he did this little thing called If I Were the Devil. If I were the devil. You want to look it up on the internet, brethren, because it's almost like a prophecy. He said, if I were the devil, I would give Americans, Canadians, everything they want. I would give them everything they seek except God. I would get religion out of the equation. I would invest the nation in big government to take care of everything they want or need in a secular way, to get rid of the values of traditional Christianity. That's what he said. How true, brethren. That's 1965. This is 2019, and we are seeing it happen before our eyes. We're past the point of no return. Our destruction is long overdue. Depression, drug addiction is at its highest level ever. It really is. You know that, brethren, because probably a lot of the people that you work with cannot function without it and are depressed. You know, you pick up the phone, I'm depressed. I understand. I understand because I have to deal with depression myself. It's depressing to a point living in this world. Those are the facts, and we need to deal with it. Depression, drug addiction is at its highest level ever. A sign of the end of the age, absolutely. Now notice these two final points, brethren, which are critical to the whole thing. Most secularists don't care. Couldn't care less about these aspects, but here it is. In our cultures, in our nations, people identifying as Christian is at its lowest level ever. It is. Frightening. It is. Because that's the culture that we embraced or had a little bit of part of as we grew up in years gone by. And now it's to the point, brethren, that if I mention the handwriting is on the wall, you'll draw a blank stare because they won't know where that came from. If I said that 20 or 30 years ago, people say, yeah, I think that's some kind of a biblical thing. I see, you know, because I've heard that religiously, they are at least aware of it. Now they're not. The conversation is not there. Our culture's final point, our culture, you know, I put that in brackets, culture, you call this a culture? It's like a horror story. It's not a culture, it's a horror story. You see the things going on. Our culture provides us with nothing to believe in. Nothing. No substance except carnality, self, and perhaps the things that the ancient king Belshazzar was focused on. A kingdom, something physical, something all about self, but not about God. That's where we have come at this time, brethren. Hosea the eighth chapter. You want to read the book of Hosea, brethren, if you haven't done it recently. Great book. Because it's directed towards the nations that are part of Ephraim. It's a message to Ephraim, time immemorial. It's not just anciently, but this goes right through to the time of Christ's return. And it also talks about Ephraim in the world tomorrow, and how God is still going to use them to convert the world under the church of God, under the spirit beings that have been born into his family. But let's take a look at Hosea, the 8th chapter, and verse 12. I have written to him. This is Britain. This is Canada. This is New Zealand, Australia, South Africa. The places of the part of the greatest empire that ever existed in the history of the world, which is what God promised to Ephraim, where they have been in these last days. Along with that, he said, I have written to him the great things of my law. Scotland used to be a hotbed of so-called traditional Christianity, where the Bible was disseminated from Scotland to go out, you know, missionaries and so on, as they call them, all around the world to at least share the Bible. They didn't understand it, like we do, but at least they did that part of it. And God says, I have written to him the great things of my law, the Bible, the greatest book ever written. The greatest book ever written. You can't put a price tag on this book, brethren. If you understand it, there's no price tag, no gold in Fort Knox that would compare to the understanding that you have been given as a member, as Winston and Mr. Goss said, because of your calling. It's that special. It says here, but they counted it as a strange thing. That's what Ephraim has done, and cast it away and ridiculed it and stomped it on the ground. It's been a horrible thing, brethren, to see religion being driven into the ground. Those who stand for so-called Christianity, even that nominal Christianity, and of course that would include us too, are despised by authorities, by education institutions, by government. We are becoming a rare breed, brethren. We really are. We're becoming a rare breed. And that's the way it's prophesied to be. Brethren, I want to close by reading a particular verse here that is a sobering verse, but it's an encouraging verse. Because we've been going over prophecies here detailing how things that were predicted long ago, we're still waiting for them to happen. And the temptation within the human mind, the human psyche is, you know, I've heard it all before. It's never going to happen. I've been hearing this for the last 50, 60 years. It's not going to happen because it hasn't happened. But you know what God says, brethren? In his time, these things are all going to happen as absolutely and as precisely as he predicted so very long ago. We are in that time period, brethren. And again, as we prepare for the Passover going forward in this wonderful Holy Day season coming up upon us, we can use this perspective, brethren, of knowing that God is going to act in this world and things are going to change. So in closing, let's read a few important verses in the book of 2 Peter, verse 3. I want to read here from an original apostle of the Church of God. And by the way, brethren, you might find it interesting to note in Ephesians, the second chapter, these apostles interacted with prophets. They're all part of the Church of God. When you see the office of apostle, it is an important thing because God has raised up that person to act in a certain way. And usually, with somebody like that, God helps them to understand prophecy in a unique way for us, so that we can understand, so that we can have our compass, and so on. And so, brethren, let's not fall into the trap, as the warning goes here, but I'm going to read these four verses in closing and just show that there is a trap living in the end of the age, because we can sort of isolate ourselves from what is going on around us. We can be part of the party atmosphere like those people at that great banquet in 539 BC at Belshazzar's banquet hall. We can say, I can drink wine. I can just be distracted. I don't need to pay attention to what's going on around me. I don't need to be ready for the end of the age. I don't need to be prepared for Christ's second coming. Oh, brethren, we do. We really do. And we need to be encouraging one another to do that. So, in closing, let's read in verse 1 of 2 Peter 3. This second epistle, beloved, I now write to you, in both which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. Brethren, he wrote that 2,000 years ago almost, but it applies to today. So you can say, Peter was actually our apostle, wasn't he? He was one of our apostles. He had a message for us today, and he's telling us to stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. Verse 2, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before of the holy prophets. Brethren, we read from the book of Daniel. We read We have read different parts of Hosea and Ezekiel and so on over the past while. Spoken before by the holy prophets and of the commandments of the apostles of the Lord and Savior. Interesting, brethren, for us today. Verse 3. Knowing this first, now this is the warning, that there shall come in the last days scoffers. Brethren, there's an industry out there who ridicule what you and I believe. Even former so-called members of the organization we've known as the Church of God, they scoff at what we believe. Brethren, they're not scoffing at you and I. They're scoffing at the Bible. God will deal with that. He really will. But that's what they're doing. They're actually scoffing at what you and I believe. Because, brethren, you and I have proved it. This is provable. This is not a fairy tale. And it's not just wishful thinking. It's written by the divine source of eternity, if you will, God. So again, it says here, last days walking after their own lusts. In other words, I don't need to repent. I don't need to get ready for Christ's return. I don't need to do that. I can just have fun, take my drugs and my pills, become divorced from reality as the world goes down into a cesspool. Verse 4. This is the temptation that we must avoid, brethren. And saying, where is the promise of his coming? Or, can you imagine that, brethren? Anybody that would say or challenge the fact that Christ said, I will return. I mean, what kind of a mindset is that? He's coming, brethren. And it would seem he's coming rather soon. The promise of his coming. For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. And people make their case. And they say, oh, well, it's not that bad. You know, my little neighborhood or my little circle, my little town, village, or city. It's not that bad. Well, we can divorce ourselves from that, brethren, but the world is in terrible shape. We've read some of those statistics. Brethren, as we look forward to the coming days of unleavened bread, let's rejoice. Let's really rejoice. Let's encourage each other. Let's draw together as a church. Let's lock arms. Let's hold the Bible, the truth of the Bible, the prophecy of the Bible, for what they are, the greatest revelation ever given to mankind, brethren. And it is our source of salvation, and it's our source of encouragement, but it also will help us to really prepare for the kingdom of God.